This is James Corbett at CorbettReport.com. It's the 11th of June 2010 here in Japan, and today I'm joined on the line by Zach Fillingham of GeopoliticalMonitor.com. Zach, thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, it's great for you to be here, and just before we get into the meat and potatoes of our conversation, I should take a moment to mention that we have talked many times in the past with GeopoliticalMonitor.com, first with Nico and then with Marcia. So perhaps we could hear a little bit about yourself and how you came to be associated with the site.
Awesome. Well, I studied international relations and then Chinese studies. I would say that my area of focus is East Asia and Chinese foreign policy in particular. I had the opportunity to live in Asia for a while, particularly Taiwan, at which point I studied Mandarin intensively. So now I speak Mandarin pretty comfortably. And I started working at the Geopolitical Monitor probably about just over a year ago. And I started out writing situation reports. More recently, I have been doing forecasters.
Excellent. Well, speaking of forecasters, Zach Fillingham, GeopoliticalMonitor.com, I wanted to get you on the program this week because a lot of commentators see the American military shaping up for yet more conflict around the globe, from the rising tensions in the Korean Peninsula to the continuing escalation of the Iran situation. But you had a forecast in the Geopolitical Monitor recently that had a bit of a different take on the long-term trend in military capabilities among NATO countries. It seems to fly in the face of this war rhetoric. So why don't you tell us about that forecast and the information it contained?
Okay, well, first off, I'd like to qualify it all by saying the forecast looks over a period of time of decades. So right now we're at this sort of historical moment where the military power of the United States and NATO countries is extremely disproportionately high to the rest of the world. So you have a hegemonic system. So looking, right now we can look at Europe and we can see these sort of various sovereign debt crises unfolding. In pretty much take your pick, any EU country. You got the UK running a deficit of around 12%. Their national debt's around 68% of their GDP. Germany, national debt, 73% of GDP. Also running a deficit. France running a deficit. Italy's deficit is 5.3. So basically, you have deficit and debt across the board. In these countries, basically, this is going to be a problem that, we're starting to see the effects now, but the problem is not just now. It's going to be over the next decade. So it's going to become a question of what is cut. And when it comes to the European countries, it is fairly certain that the axe is going to come down on military spending. There are certain countries that we already see that occurring right now, such as Germany, which just basically announced that they're considering cutting their army of active soldiers from 250,000 to 150,000, cutting 40,000 jobs in the military, and slashing their defense spending. We have France, the government of France, which is expected to make similar announcements over the next couple of weeks. And we have the United Kingdom, which is running a pretty serious deficit itself. And we heard earlier this week from David Cameron that there are quote-unquote painful cuts coming. So basically, and the UK is also currently undergoing a strategic defense review, which will probably come out with a series of recommendations for cutting procurement. They might even talk about revisiting their debate about renovating their independent nuclear deterrent in the form of the Trident program. So basically, across Europe, over the next 10 years, you're going to see a reduction in military spending and right. As a trend.
Right. So exactly. So assuming that the economic collapse we see playing out in Europe right now continues in the direction it's unfolding, then obviously military spending will just have to decrease because of the constraints on most of the budgets in European nations. And I think that that's pretty inevitable the way things are going right now. But how about things? How are things shaping up in the Far East and specifically in China?
Well, actually, sorry, if you allow me to digress for a second, I said all that and I didn't even touch down on the United States. So the United States is a bit of a different situation. Obviously, their spending is way higher than Europe. And their current deficits in absolute terms are extremely high right now. And all you need to do is look at basically take your pick of any Congressional Budget Office report on sort of forecasting budgetary trends in America over the next 10 years, and you'll find a series of like rather depressing sort of forecasts. One of which, the one number that really stands out, jumps off the sheet, is the amount of interest payments that the government of the United States is going to need to make in 2020, according to the CBO. So currently that number is around $207 billion a year. In 10 years, according to the CBO, that number will be $723 billion. So if you combine that amount of money with the sort of unfunded liabilities of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, you have a massive budgetary pressure that's going to sort of push out defense spending in the United States as well. So is it cool if I talk about China now?
Yes, okay, absolutely.
sorry. My answers can be a bit long-winded. But so basically, when you have the West, you have, as I was just saying, Europe and the United States, you have a downward budgetary pressures on defense spending. In the East, when it comes to and East Asia, South Asia, basically orbiting around China and India, you have sort of upward pressures on defense spending. For these countries are cash rich because a lot of the debt that exists in the Western world is held by countries in the East now. And you also have a sort of changing military dynamic in East Asia, and where it's going, no one's really sure. But basically, the theory goes that as American presence declines, as America declines as a sort of fundamental hegemonic power in East Asia, there will form a sort of security vacuum, and the sort of constituent powers within Asia are going to need to sort of up their spending and basically rely on themselves for defense, and that will obviously create an arms race, which we're already seeing when it comes to China and India developing their navies. You can look at East Asia military spending as right now a naval arms race between China and India, and even more recently Vietnam's getting into the mix and some other Southeast Asian countries. And over the long term, it will also be probably a arms race to do with air power as well.
So what does that trend mean for the long-term prospects of the balance of power in the region, including, of course, in the Korean Peninsula and also in Taiwan?
Well, it's an interesting question because basically, there are these pressures that exist on American defense spending, there's basically going to have to be decisions made within Washington as to what the overall military doctrine of the United States is going to be moving forward. And I'm talking about, 10 years from now. So I'm not saying that the sort of Cold War alliance system that exists to this day that has sort of buttressed East Asian security up until now, I'm not saying that's going to go away. It's just going to lessen in importance. And basically, as that sort of recedes, China is going to fill the space. And basically, it remains to be seen, this is the big question, whether the international institutions that exist now, like the UN, ASEAN, plus three, all the international framework, whether that's robust and legitimate enough to sort of take the problems that are going to arise from Chinese rising power and give countries an opportunity to solve it in a peaceful way. For example, if all the actors in East Asia abide by the rules of the UN and accept the legitimacy of the UN, then it's possible that, say, territorial disputes in the South China Sea between China and Vietnam could be resolved in a sort of bureaucratic and peaceful way. On the other hand, if those institutions aren't respected and adhered to, you have the real possibility of actual military conflict between China and Vietnam, for example. And as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, all questions of sort of future military forecasting aside, that sort of military intervention is extremely expensive and arguably, and you know, the jury's still out as to how effective it is. So basically, you're going to be seeing East Asian countries boosting their own militaries and balancing off against one another. And the Cold War alliance system will be one side, and it sort of remains to be seen what the other side will be. It will center around China, probably have Burma, North Korea. But then again, you never know. That area, that region is so volatile in a way that you never know. You mentioned two of the major flashpoints, the Korean Peninsula and Taiwan, which are very, very interesting examples, because Taiwan is a good sort of indication as to the changing military dynamics in the world, all right? So you've always had a situation that the Americans were able to maintain an advantage in Taiwan via providing the Taiwanese government with weapons that were of higher quality than the Chinese side, right? So even though even though China aimed a huge amount of missiles, short-range ABMs, short-range ballistic missiles at Taiwan, Taiwan always had this sort of qualitative advantage in their air force that basically made it so that a Chinese invasion would be sort of foolhardy. Over the last 15 years, that has changed. And now that has changed to the point where, you know, there's a real argument out there as to whether or not today, like no question, not 5 years from now, today, whether the United States could effectively defend Taiwan if China wanted to attack it.
That's right. And that's just another key indication of just how much the dynamic is changing and how much America is losing its hegemonic position, which it still does maintain at the moment, but obviously coming more and more into question as the economic collapse continues to unfold. So extremely interesting time. And I guess what you're saying is basically we're seeing a reshaping of the world order that's held at least since the post-Cold War era.
Yes, we will definitely be seeing that, particularly in East Asia, as the, you know, rising powers. But I think it's important also to say that a lot of people like looking into the past as examples of rising powers clashing with sort of declining powers. And I think that a very important distinction needs to be made in this situation that we're going to have going forward, insofar that the rising powers are actually, they're already a part of the system. The system has made them rich, and the system has, to a large degree, allowed for their rise. So unlike situations in the past, the rising powers aren't trying to sort of smash the system and recreate something that affords them a bigger, you know, a part. So we're not necessarily going to see the same sort of dynamic as we have in the past.
Well, that's an interesting take, I suppose. And I guess that is obviously true insofar as China has risen to the status that it has by becoming the industrial engine for the Western world. So it's, I guess it is an interesting take and maybe something almost unique in history. But of course, these forecasts are no gazing into crystal balls. They're just extrapolations from what's currently happening in the world. So what are some factors that could happen between now and the decades out in the future that this forecast is forecasting that could change the dynamic of what you're seeing playing out right now?
Oh, well, there's tons. Keeping in East Asia, how China behaves is a huge determinant as to what is going to happen going forward. For example, there's a lot of countries in East Asia that are naturally have an aversion to a rising China. They're scared about China's sort of rising diplomatic, economic, and military might in the world. And as we've seen, China actually has been ramping up its defense spending. From 1999 to 2008, it's increased 194%. So basically, up until now, China has had a relatively benevolent foreign policy, especially when it came to Southeast Asian neighbors. And this has been aimed at sort of alleviating their fears over a rising China and basically trying not to drive them into the arms of the American alliance system. But recently we've seen a more assertive China in Southeast Asia, one that's sort of, increasingly sending ships into the South China Sea and trying to assert its sovereignty over the Paracel Islands, and even going so far as to plan on building infrastructure on the island. So this is all a grab at making a sort of territorial claim on petroleum reserves in the South China Sea. So basically, you might have just a switch in the Chinese mindset, a switch towards the sort of past benevolence, towards a more assertive foreign policy, which would make sense because obviously as China rises, it has more and more interests that it needs to protect. And basically that sort of leads into a more aggressive foreign policy. You might have that change the attitude of sort of other actors in East Asia, throw them into the arms of the alliance system, which in turn triggers like a more conventional realism-based balancing of alliance versus alliance. You also have the Korean Peninsula, which is at the best of times totally impossible to forecast what's going to go on there. We've seen so many crises come and go on the Korean Peninsula that I think we can get sort of just content in the fact that nothing big is ever going to happen. But that's not the case because the North Korean regime is so, first of all, no one really knows anything about it. And second of all, what we do know about those sort of authoritarian regimes that are based on personalities and cliques within the government is they're not very stable. And something like the sinking of the Chonin can turn into, we don't even know if that was ordered from the top in North Korea. That could have been the result of a sort of intergovernmental or a power struggle within the government. And in that kind of situation, when you have certain blocks within the government who are competing with other blocks, you might have one block that's trying to grab the mantle of revolutionary legitimacy and another one who wants to sort of open up in a more Chinese-style economic reform. You never know what's going to come out of that. And the military situation that exists on the Korean Peninsula, even though you have America as this hegemonic power, Korea and Japan, real military power in East Asia. I mean, the simple reality is that the way that the line of control is set up and the proximity of Seoul to the line of control makes it so it doesn't matter. I mean, there's a number that's thrown around. I think it's about over 1 million people dying in the first hour of that conflict. And that's because you have so much artillery pointed at Seoul, laced with chemical weapons and they're rumored to be biological weapons. Just as a side note, if you want to hear more about this, go to geopoliticalmonitor.com and the forecaster sinking of the Chonin audio. I go through the sort of various claims as to North Korea's chemical, biological, and nuclear program. Anyway, you got these weapons pointed at Seoul. It doesn't matter. The conflict breaks out. The weapons go, and that's that. There's just no way to stop an artillery shell with a chemical weapon warhead. There's no Patriot missile for that. So even with this sort of predominant hegemonic power, that presents a military situation that cannot, barring a preemptive strike, which would incur massive casualties on the North Korean civilian population, there's no solution to it. So the Korean Peninsula is definitely something that will remain as something that is a total X factor and can totally affect the power dynamics in East Asia moving forward.
Well, speaking of impossible to predict, obviously the Middle East region is another one of those regions where all bets are really off the table when people start forecasting what could play out. But what are some of the dynamics at work there and what types of things might be transpiring at the moment that might change this forecast?
Well, just to link it back to what we were talking about, it's interesting. I mean, when we look at the Middle East now, we got to look at it through the lens of this sort of failed war model when it comes to Iraq and Afghanistan. a sort of preemptive democratizing battle, whatever it's to be called in the future. Basically, it's kind of clear that it failed when it comes to sort of fiscal efficiency, at least, at the very least. So it's hugely expensive, arguably effective. I mean, we won't know for another 5 years till the Americans pull out, but it's not looking good. So basically, that effectively takes that off the table when it comes to a country like Iran. Because, well, first of all, it'd be economically ruinous for the United States right now to embark on that. Basically, it's impossible for the United States to do that right now. So I think Iran knows this. And when it comes to Israel launching a sort of preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities, the way they're situated within Iran and the way that Israel has its sort of air power. Sorry, I don't know specifics. I just read a report to this effect. Basically, Israel cannot sort of launch an air sortie without incurring a high degree of casualties itself and a sort of minimal level of like a minimal chance of success. So from a military standpoint, it's somewhat of an impossible situation. I mean, you can launch on Iran. I don't think it's going to happen. Basically, I think that, in my opinion, if I were to forecast it, we're going to see sort of this continued dance around the UN and the sanctions. You're going to continue to see China sort of standing up and defending Iran against really harsh sanctions, like sanctions on the Iranian petroleum industry. And this is obvious. This is because China has a stake in Iranian energy. And eventually, we're going to see a nuclear Iran. And basically, that doesn't matter if Israel decides to take a shot at this sort of 30% chance of success airstrike and successfully take out Iranian reactors, then we're just going to be playing through the same scenario, 5 to 10 years from now. And it's interesting that what we were talking about before and the sort of how the sort of military rebalancing might affect the world, you're probably going to see a lot of countries going for nuclear weapons, because nuclear weapons are the cheapest, easiest way to attain sort of security in an international environment that's increasingly unpredictable and not in flux. So
absolutely. Well, it is an extremely interesting situation at the moment, and I think we're going to be in for some surprises as well as some of these things that we're talking about today. But at any rate, we're almost completely out of time. So just to in wrap up here, Zach, can you tell people about geopoliticalmonitor.com and what they can find there?
Thanks. We at Geopolitical Monitor try to provide high-quality research, situation reports, which are basically high-level analysis on an event or a region, forecasting, which is looking at a certain issue and predicting where it's going to go. The forecast can be short-term or long-term, like the Western power in decline forecast is over a decade. We also provide backgrounders, which are very in-depth research on a given issue, and we have a weekly audio podcast as well, which is basically just me giving an extended monologue on a given situation. But so just come over and take a look.
All right, Zach Fillingham, geopoliticalmonitor.com. Thank you for joining us, and I hope I can talk to you again in the future.
Totally. Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.